Hello and welcome to the Good Fiction Podcast. Join us as we begin Things That Charlie Did, Chapter 1. Things That Charlie Did by Rodney Mathers. In misfortune lies the seed of future triumph. Dean Koontz. Introduction. Money isn't all it's cracked up to be. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Only rich people say that. Or this guy must have a lot of money to be saying something like that. But the fact of the matter is I'm not rich, nor do I have a lot of money. Oh, I'm comfortable in my modest house with my wife. My career working in the publishing business has created a nice life financially. But my wife and I have had to scratch and save for years in order for me to retire. Still, I've had a good life. So let me make one thing perfectly clear from the start. I'm not rich. But my career has given me a close-up look at people who are. People like to read books written by rich people, so in the course of my job as an editor, I got to know several. Rich people, that is. They write books about the paths they took to get rich. I correct their grammar and spelling, then thousands of people buy those books, hopelessly looking for a way to be like the author. The stories are always similar. A man or a woman invents something or climbs their way to the top of the business and becomes wealthy beyond anyone's expectations, blah, blah, blah. After 37 years in the business, I got to where I couldn't tell one story from the next. The people that spent their hard-earned money on the books probably felt the same way, too. I doubt anyone reading a biography of a man who got rich after inventing the reversible widget was able to change their life much. As luck would have it, though, just 12 months before my scheduled retirement, I started work on a project that would change my thinking about all of that. Oh, I'm not saying that if you read the last book I edited, you would see some sort of instant path to fortune and fame. No, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, the book is only part of the story. It's what happened while the book was being written, too. Let's see. How should I begin? Things That Charlie Did. Chapter 1. Meet Charles Charlie T. Duncan. At 37 years old, he had risen from one of the 12 foster children living in a group home in Houston, Texas, to one of the country's top and most sought-after corporate attorneys. His work for Exxon had his salary in the $3 to $4 million a year range before he quit and started his own consulting firm. When oil companies got in trouble, they came to him, and his fees started in the mid to high seven figures, sometimes more. Not bad for someone that hasn't even made 40 years old yet. A lot of how Charlie was when I first met him can be summed up in the T part of his name. It was always suspicious that the T was something he had added, because once when I asked him what it stood for, he commented, "Together. Charles Duncan is together." This certainly appeared to be the case. Let's start with his stuff, and then we'll go to Charlie himself. I guess when you're together, as Charlie put it, you take a lot of pride in your stuff. The most obvious item would be your house, and Charlie loved his. Who wouldn't? Perched on a hill along the northern coast of California. His huge house was a welcome change from the hot, humid summers of Houston. Complete with a tennis court, a riding stable, and a full-size indoor Olympic pool, the three-person staff provided Mr. Together with whatever he wanted. To some, the house was more a museum than like a home, but the two-story marble entryway was accented with a crystal chandelier. Charlie had paid $30,000 for it, used. But the chandelier was only the beginning. Once inside the house, things got even better. Floor-to-ceiling windows with wood-paneled rooms were standard in the house. The front rooms overlooked waves crashing onto the rugged shoreline below. The rocky mountainous Pacific Ocean coast could be seen for miles in either direction. Throughout the house, Charlie had collected pieces of sculpture and other rare collectibles. Having always been a history buff, he sought after and bought things like Civil War swords, suits of armor, and antique guns. Included in his collection were also rare bronze and marble busts and statuettes of various presidents and world leaders. He even had a full-size white marble statue of Napoleon Bonaparte, said to have been posed for in person by the man himself. The statue stood in the entryway under the lights of the chandelier. The other items were sprinkled throughout the house. He liked plants, too. They were everywhere. Scarcely a corner in the house was left uncovered by some sort of tall potted plant or a short one perched upon a table made especially for that purpose. The gardens, particularly in the back of the house, were very well maintained and manicured. Charlie did a lot of that work himself. In fact, he spent more time working in the gardens that surrounded the tennis court and stable than he did playing tennis or riding his horse, Mandy. Now, that's not to say he didn't love his $100,000 full-blooded Arabian gelding. In a lot of ways, Mandy could be his best friend at times. Simply put, Mandy listened. She listened to his gripes and whines as they rode down steep, narrow trails to the thin, white, sanded stretch of beach that stood between the jagged rocks and crashing Pacific Ocean during low tide. Riding her bareback, Charlie would take her bridle off and allow her to run free for a long time along the beach. The beautiful gray horse with long white mane and braided white tail would stomp her front right hoof, duck her head, and neigh when Charlie called her. Sitting on her back, they often would stand upon the beach watching it slowly disappear with the incoming tide. Many times they would stand on the beach until the tide covered Mandy's knees. She would triumphantly trot back to the trail, leading back to the stables, splashing the salty water high into the air. The horse seemed to enjoy the slight degree of danger just as much as Charlie did. He felt guilty at times about not spending as much time as he should with the horse. It didn't keep him from getting his exercise, keeping the beautiful seasonal purple, red, and yellow and white flowers blooming. The guilt was overshadowed by Charlie's obsessive need for the gardens to be perfect, always. And they always were, too. Walking along the grounds in the springtime was a beautiful and refreshing experience, one I came to experience and enjoy many times while Charlie was working on his book. Actually, it was time he should have been working on the book, but was pulling weeds in the garden instead many times. Sometimes, since Charlie lived in such a secluded area, I would be asked to spend the night and always gladly accepted. There wasn't anything there to be afraid of. Still, once I retired to the bedroom that Charlie eventually called your room, the house gave off a bad vibe. As the young people say, or used to say anyway, it wasn't a spooky thing. No, it was more of a lonely thing. That huge house, worth millions, with beautiful ocean below, was empty. Except for Charlie and his help, I was the only other person to spend any amount of time there. By day, Charlie was a social, happy-going guy. Whoever was hiring him would put him up in the finest hotels and cities all over the world for months at a time. While away, he was in the rich set. Attending dinner parties and various other social gatherings were actually part of his job. He got to know the leaders of corporations and even met the leaders of nations, who were more than willing to pay large sums of money for his expertise as an attorney. But once he returned home, it was to that beautiful but empty house. And it wasn't as if Charlie had to be alone. With that kind of money and those good looks of his, he surely could have enjoyed the company of a lady friend, tall, with brown flowing hair that neatly fell over his collar and covered the tops of his ears. His time spent gardening in the cool Northern California sun kept his skin tan. He also liked blue jeans and, while around the house, was most likely to be seen in Levi's, a polo, and a new pair of Adidas. It always struck me as strange that someone who could be so caught up in the fast lane one minute could be so opposite the next. That was Charlie, though. If you came to the mansion looking for a cold beer, forget it. No alcohol on the grounds at all. Funny, though, I did see him pick up a cigarette from time to time. He told me once that it wasn't uncommon to be offered cocaine or marijuana while mingling with the young and rich of the world. His answer was always no, and nothing like that was allowed in his home. The road that led to the top of the hill where the house sat twisted and turned its way through the treeless hills covered with short grass. Once off the main highway, the road was barely wide enough for oncoming traffic to pass. It didn't matter, though, because I really can't remember ever seeing another car. There really would never be any reason for anyone to be on that last stretch of road that steeply climbed to the top of the hill and dead-ended at the gates of the mansion. The first time up there, we really hadn't discussed what to do once one reaches the gate. After bumbling around like a fool for several minutes, I finally figured out there was a button to push, an intercom to speak into, and a camera. I'll never forget that I was surprised to hear a voice that clearly wasn't his on the intercom. He had made such a big deal during our conversations over the phone of how he liked to be alone when not working. The huge two-story concrete and stone house was a majestic sight. That feeling I had the very first time I was there, it's the same feeling I had every time I went. It's hard to find the words to describe it because it wasn't strange, no, but it wasn't a happy feeling either. The place seemed to give off a lonely, sad sort of mood that you felt sort of deeply. Once parked in the drive and out of my car, the strong breeze from the ocean several hundred feet below touched me inside and out. A quick look around the driveway on the way to the main doors of the house was less impressive. One would expect to see someone of Charlie's stature in life with a Porsche or two, a Rolls, or maybe a Ferrari. Nope, the only car other than mine in the driveway was an older model VW Bug. The left quarter panel was red, rusty, kind of the color of a primer paint, and the rest of the car was a dreadful yellow. Surely that car belonged to the voice I heard on the intercom. Once at the doors of the grand house, I pushed the button next to them and heard the pleasant sounding chime. By the way, I later learned when you're rich, it's called a chime instead of a doorbell. Almost immediately, the large solid brass knobs turned and both doors opened. There was Charlie. We had met in person only once before, and that was when the publishing company introduced me to him as his editor the day he had signed his contract. He smiled broadly and extended his hand. His white teeth stood in contrast to his tan, and his grip was firm but not like crushing from someone who was out to prove something. He invited me in and shut the doors behind me. The pleasant smell of fresh flowers and potpourri hit me immediately. We walked past the statue of Napoleon, under the great chandelier, and into a room just off to the left where books lined the walls from floor to ceiling. There was also a desk of mahogany on which a laptop sat, propped open with its wires dangling off the end. He offered me a seat, and before I had settled into my chair, he said those two little words that publishers and editors hate to hear. I'm stuck. Thank you for listening. Join us next time as we continue with Things That Charlie Did. I'm Rodney Mathers. Goodbye for now.